Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Teachers and other state employees in Wisconsin have kept up their protests against Governor Scott Walker's plan to limit future collective bargaining rights. The budget battle in Wisconsin is similar to those likely to grip other state capitals in the coming weeks. It's already in full swing here in Washington. Joining me in the studio to talk about the role of public unions and efforts to cut spending, Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute and Ron Blackwell. He's chief economist for the AFL-CIO. But first, joining us by phone from Indianapolis is Mitch Daniels. He's governor of Illinois. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. You just promoted me, I guess, because this is Indiana out here, Diane. But
I sure did. Well, that's okay. You never know.
They're a great state. I wouldn't want to trade places with them in certain respects right now, but they're a great state and great neighbors.
You never know. Governor Daniels, Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, has called you his great mentor and inspiration. To what extent do you agree with the tack he's taking there in Wisconsin?
Well, I hadn't heard that Scott had said that, but in general, I think, you know, he's simply doing what he promised the people of Wisconsin he would do. Their state is in a very desperate financial shape. They've overspent and overpromised, he was elected explicitly to try to bring some economic rationality back to that state, and I think the attacks on him are predictable, but I do hope that in general, he'll make the progress that his state needs him to make.
Of course, the unions he has cited have already acceded to some budget cuts. So what is it about collective bargaining rights excluding police, fire, and others that's so special, and are you doing the same?
Well, first of all, you know, collective bargaining is a very important part of the fabric of a free society, but even its most passionate advocates over the decades, Franklin Delano Roosevelt being a great example, said it really had no place in the public sector. And we have evolved to a situation where the privileged elite in American society really are government unions, which no longer represent people who are paid less than the public that they serve, but are paid much more and with much richer benefits and perfect job security in many cases. So I think bringing some balance back to that is necessary if states like Wisconsin and our nation, for that matter, are going to regain our balance and not kill the American dream for everybody else.
Help me to understand, is there concrete evidence that Wisconsin public employees or Indiana public employees are better paid than their counterparts in the private sector?
Well, heavens, yes. The average federal employee is paid 50% more than the average taxpayer who supports them. The average teacher in the state of Indiana is paid 22% more with much more generous benefits, almost perfect job security, and the shorter work year. So there isn't any question about that. By the way, in some cases, that's entirely appropriate. It's just that the balance may have gotten a little out of hand, Diane. And Indiana's in a little different shape. We are not. We've been able to keep books balanced here and without all the severe cuts. I'm incredibly proud of the job that our state employees are doing. So we're not in quite the same position or advocating quite the same things they are up in Madison.
Help me to understand how taking away the rights of collective bargaining would fix or help to fix the budget shortfall.
Well, the most powerful special interests in America today are the government unions. They're the leading financial contributors. They have the biggest PACs. They have muscle. A lot of times their contracts provide for time off to go politic and lobby. And over the course of the last few decades, if there were ever injustices or shortfalls in how we took care of government employees, it's been fixed and overfixed. And so I think that the, what he's trying to do is, in the public interest, interrupt this circuitous process in which taxpayer dollars pay for very solid salaries for government employees. Some of the money is siphoned into political union dues, goes back into politics, and elects people who will vote for more and more and more. Everybody knows this is going on, and it is, really, I think, part of the problem, not the whole problem, but part of the problem that has gotten us into the debts we're into and the bad corner we're in fiscally.
One of the curious aspects of this whole discussion in Wisconsin is that state troopers, police, and firefighter unions who supported the governor are exempt from this pending decertification process. How do you figure, Governor Daniels?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on what the exact situation is in Wisconsin. All I know is that many, many years of excess up there, feather-bedded payrolls, very expensive salaries and benefits, have got that state, like so many other states, in a terrible fiscal hole. It's been very unfair to the taxpayers who have to pay for all this. And, the governor, the new governor up there, promised to try to do something about it, and I think he should be commended, not castigated, for trying to live up to his promise.
I still am totally in the dark as to how bargaining and the bargaining power of unions and taking that away is going to affect the budget process.
Well, if my newspaper is correct, he's not talking about that. He's talking about narrowing the scope down to wages.
But they've already conceded wages.
Well, this is, I think he's trying to fix a structural problem, which I've demonstrated or discussed to you already, Diane. The problem comes from the, forced expropriation, whether they like it or not, of money that started with the taxpayer, from the salaries of government workers, circulated back into a political machine that is the most powerful out there. If you're worried about special interest power and special interest pressure in America, that's the government unions is where you ought to start.
What about, how would you compare the government unions to, say, the oil lobby?
Well, in many ways, they're vastly more effective. They're year in, year out, they're the number one donor of money into our political process. And plus, in many cases, they can deliver muscle that these other interests that you might ask me about cannot, people and so forth. Often it's in the terms of their contracts that they get time off to politic.
I want to just expand this discussion for a moment because I know you were director of the Office of Management and Budget during the Bush years. During those years, the federal budget went from black to red. I wonder, in retrospect, do you think you might have done things differently?
Well, that administration could have made some different choices, but let me point out that any deficits run then are a tiny fraction of what we're doing now. Current administration will triple the national debt on the track they're on, more in a few years than all the president's predecessors, including President Bush, ever added. So, of course, things could have been done differently here and there, but just as recently as 2007, we had a tiny deficit, less than 2% of gross national product, and one we would love dearly to get back to anytime, frankly, in the foreseeable future.
And then, of course, came both the cost of the wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan. I seem to recall a report by Lawrence Lindsay estimating that the cost of Operation Iraqi Freedom would run between $100 and $200 billion, and you thought that was very high.
Well, I was right and he was wrong. The question at the time was, what would we were just asked at OMB to make an estimate, what would it cost to win a war with the Iraqi army and stay 6 months? The answer we gave turned out to be a little on the safe side. No one asked, because no one knew, what would it cost to defeat the Iraqi army and stay 8 years? If anybody had been asked that question, they'd have gotten a very, very different answer from the expert professionals that I was supporting at OMB back then.
I gather that you delivered a recent address at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee. What was the gist of the message you gave them?
I said that America is facing a threat right now that's just about as severe as those we've faced militarily in the past, in the form of the enormous debt that we have. It's mathematically certain. It's not an ideological point of view. It's a matter of arithmetic that on the current track, we will not be a successful or even self-governing country if we go that deep and hawk to other people. And so that we need bold action. And I think the speech was fairly characterized as more of a challenge to people I agree with than to people I might disagree with.
Mitch Daniels.
That, people who call themselves Republicans or conservatives need to step up to this in a very specific and very forthright way.
And all right. And I'm afraid we're out of time, Governor. Thanks for joining us. Mitch Daniels, Governor of Indiana. And after our conversation with Governor Mitch Daniels of Indiana, we turn now to Chris Edwards. He's Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, and Ron Block. Why do I keep saying Blackwell? Blackwell, Chief Economist for the AFL-CIO. And Ron, we have an email here from Johnny. He says, please do not allow the statements of the governor on the phone to go unchallenged. Government employees are not paid 50% more than private sector. Would you really call the unions the most powerful interest and special interest group in this country? If the governor thinks that union management is the elite in this country, then we ought to consider a new definition of unique.
Well, I absolutely agree with both of those points. I think the idea that public sector unions are the most powerful interest in the country is bizarre. I wish we had more power. We'd be able to defend the middle class more effectively than we're now able to do that. I would ask Governor Daniels if he's not concerned about the organized power of finance in our nation's politics, which is financing much of the activity and have poured over $1 billion into our politics to elect politicians like Mitch Daniels and the governor in Wisconsin.
All right. And turning to you, Chris Edwards, here's another email. Let's see, from Kim, who says, do your homework. If nothing is done about collective bargaining, this is what will happen. The state will cut funding to the municipalities. The municipalities, in other words, school districts, will levy taxes to make up the difference. They're allowed to do this in Wisconsin without any voter approval or referenda. I know I pay these taxes on my property. Chris?
Well, I think public sector unions do raise the cost of government at both the state and local levels, and they prevent often needed reforms, like in pension plans. Many states have pension plans that are deeply in debt, and they need to be reformed. But I'm also against collective bargaining in the public sector for philosophical reasons. I think they deny choice in two ways. Government services like fire and police are often monopolies, and when you tie a monopoly union on top of it, it makes for inefficiency. I mean, if consumers have the choice to go to, say, a grocery store that has unionized workforce or a grocery store that doesn't, you don't have that same sort of choice in government. And I would also say that in the states where they have the collective bargaining in the public sector, you're denying individuals who want to serve their state, who don't like the union, from serving their state without being forced to pay union dues or join the union.
All right. And joining us now from the state capitol in Madison, Wisconsin, is Ben Mansky. He's a member of the faculty of Madison College and a spokesperson for a Liberty Tree. Good morning to you, Ben. Thanks for joining us.
You bet, Diane. Thanks for having me.
Please explain Liberty Tree.
Absolutely. We're a pro-democracy organization that's based in Wisconsin. We were founded in 2004. And we work to expand democracy in all areas of American life, including the right to organize. And when you look at what is happening in Wisconsin right now, it is very clear that choices are being taken away from workers. This is not a plan on the part of the governor to expand workers' power. It is to take away our ability to self-organize.
Describe for us the scene there this morning.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that.
Can you describe for us the scene there this morning?
Absolutely. People here are very tired, but there have been many people traveling from all over Wisconsin to come here and to relieve those who have been here all week. What has not been reported in the national media is that there have actually been major demonstrations all over Wisconsin, including in the far north woods. 3,000 people turned out just the other day to demonstrate against this proposal, this attack on workers' rights. In Madison right now, it's gotten somewhat colder. We had freezing rain, but yet there are already thousands collecting at the Capitol, and we expect the momentum to start to pick up again as the week goes on.
Is it true that public employees union leaders have already agreed to upping contributions for pensions and health care?
Well, the reality is the labor movement is not a monolith. There are many different unions here. There are some labor leaders who have said, yes, we understand that the governor is a conservative and that we will have to negotiate with him, and we are willing to negotiate with him on benefits. But where the labor movement across the board is united, and also I would say many young people who want to have a future in the state are united with us, is on this question of collective bargaining and the right to organize. You know, I think it's kind of a canard. It's a joke to suggest that somehow workers have rights and free choice otherwise. When you go to the workplace, you do not have free speech rights. That's what the Supreme Court has said. There are all kinds of rights that are denied to us. At least the First Amendment right to collectively associate, to advocate in our own interests, must be protected if we're to have a democracy in this country.
However, you have said that you were anticipating that this call for an end to collective bargaining was coming, but you just didn't expect it would come this soon. What do you mean?
Well, to be very clear, we actually had no idea that he was going to go after collective bargaining. He did not campaign on that question. We knew that there were going to be very harsh austerity measures proposed. This governor is not only going after organized labor, but he's going after students. He's proposing what sounds to be a 26% tuition hike in the UW system. He wants to privatize the UW-Madison, the home of Bucky Badger. He wants to cut spending for the poor and for social services by 20% across the board. So we knew that was coming. We knew something bad was coming, but we didn't realize it was coming this quickly. And what has happened this past week, I mean, you have to get a sense of perspective. Everybody should. This is a state of 6 million people. There were 70,000 people demonstrating on Saturday, nearly a 71 margin, according to local police, in terms of those who are pro-union versus anti. This has totally changed the politics in the state.
But, Ben, help me to understand and show me that you understand that when the governor says the state is broke, he means it. What do you think ought to be done?
Well, the state is broke because of two main factors. Number one, the poor and the middle class have been getting squeezed for an entire generation, and we are unable to pay any more. And yet, at the same time, the reality is that taxes on the very wealthy and taxes on major corporations have declined dramatically and in many cases have disappeared. So we are only broke because the poor and the middle class cannot pay any more and because the wealthy are not paying. And there is a revenue side to this question. We must tax the wealthy. We must tax major corporations. If we do that, there is no fiscal crisis in Wisconsin.
When were those taxes on major corporations given, those tax breaks given?
Well, to give you a sense, I was born in 1974, so I'm 36 years old. And when I was born, the top marginal tax rate in the state of Wisconsin was between 11 and 12% for the wealthy. In addition, you had taxation on major corporations in the 1950s that headed into the 30 percentile. What has happened in the last generation, it's happened under governors of both parties, both Republicans and Democrats, and this has happened nationally as well, is that that burden has been cut away in terms of what those most able to afford it have shouldered, and it has been passed on through all kinds of other means to those who can least afford it. So, for example, tuition across the country has skyrocketed because essentially young people are being taxed, they're being put into indentured servitude in order to enable tax breaks for the rich. And that is part of what is going on here. Wisconsinites are aware that we have a structural crisis. We're aware that it's not inevitable, that it is actually caused by an agenda coming out of the Chamber of Commerce, out of the National Association of Manufacturers. We've had enough. It's gotten to the point where it's insufferable. And when the governor not only said that he was going to effectively cut our wages through these pension and health care changes by 10 to 15%, but he was also going to take away our ability to advocate in our own interests, that's what caused this uprising. That's what caused this Wisconsin wave.
And with the Democratic representatives having disappeared for the time being, refusing to return to the state capitol to create a quorum necessary to take any legislation seriously, what do you figure is going to happen?
Well, this is going to go on for a long time because the governor is not negotiating. He is not picking up the phone. He refuses to appear in public. He's refused to hold hearings. Remember that this proposal was introduced on a Friday morning. That is not the time in which you introduce a proposal in which you want to have discussion and debate. And he has been very consistent and steadfast in his own mind that he is not going to negotiate with the literally hundreds of thousands of people, I would say a million people, who will be pushed over the edge by this proposal in terms of the immediate families who will be impacted. So this is going to go on for a long time.
All right. I think Chris Edwards of Cato would like to ask a question.
You bet.
Well, you talk about collective bargaining in the public sector as if it was a fundamental right, but is it really? I mean, there's a dozen states, including where I live in Virginia, where there is no collective bargaining allowed in the public sector. And in Virginia, for example, that law was put into place by Democratic Governor Douglas Wilder about two decades ago. So teachers and firemen in Virginia can form voluntary associations, and they do, to lobby, and I'm all for that. They can lobby all they want, but they don't need collective bargaining to do that. So do you really need, isn't it really a privilege, collective bargaining in the public sector in states like Wisconsin, and not a right, because after all, in Virginia, they don't have it?
Ben,
let's be clear on two things, and that's a fair question. Number one, not only is he going after collective bargaining, but he's also going after fair share dues collection. He essentially wants to bankrupt the union movement in Wisconsin. So that is something that has not been discussed, but it is also obviously very serious in the short term. It would mean the collapse of organized labor, and that's why this is seen as a political attack. It's not a fiscal solution. But secondly, in terms of the question of whether collective bargaining is a right or a privilege, I think working people have always seen collective bargaining as a right. The state, the government, and oftentimes the courts in American history have not. And it's important for us to remember that 100 years ago, labor unions in many parts of the country were unlawful. They were suppressed. And that is what the court said. Working people did not accept that. We had to change state law in order to essentially change what came down from the courts. But that does not mean that we do not have a natural right to engage in collective bargaining. And I think if the governor takes away these collective bargaining rights through changing state statute, what he risks is returning Wisconsin to the period of 50 or 60 years ago when we did not have labor peace. After all, collective bargaining was really a negotiated agreement to maintain labor peace and to settle things amicably. And this governor is not doing that.
All right. And I think Ron Blackwell has a question.
I think, Ben, by the way, I want to congratulate you and the others that are there in that cold weather in Madison, Wisconsin. You're inspiring the labor movement throughout the country. But
I
have to say, trade unions, and from their very beginning, have seen the right of freedom of opinion and freedom of association and freedom to organize unions with their brothers and sisters at work and bargain collectively with their employers as fundamental human rights, whether or not they're represented in law and whether or not it's in the public sector or the private sector, and that is one of the core principles of democracy. And it's by challenging this gratuitously that the governor, using the argument about budget deficits, challenging these fundamental rights gratuitously, has provoked this enormous reaction, not just in Wisconsin, but throughout the country. The stakes in this struggle are extremely high. But I think the fact that the unions have signaled their clear intent to bargain collectively to resolve this budget problem, which really doesn't matter. And the governor has, instead of doing that, rejected collective bargaining, abandoned the bargaining table, and challenged the very existence of these workers' essential freedoms, shows exactly what the political motivation is here.
Ron Blackwell, he's chief economist for the AFL-CIO. Ben Manske, I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Okay. And joining us now is Gerald McEntee. He's president at the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Talk about why you think public employees are front and center in state budget battles.
Well, I think with the influx of Republican, the members of the Republican Party winning various gubernatorial seats, whereas when they were running, they talked about the creation of jobs and jobs, and now they're in a mode of paying back public workers who have had the right to organize and bargain collectively and using their power in a way to take that from them. And I think that's, and they're making the fact that budget deficits are due to public workers in individual states. Now, Diane, that's just not accurate. I mean, in Wisconsin, when Scott Walker came in, he was given a balanced budget. Within about 4 or 5 months, he took the balanced budget and turned it into a negative by giving tax cuts to corporations and to the ultra-rich. And as a result, he has created this problem in Wisconsin. Our people, who represent thousands of workers in Wisconsin and represent thousands of state employees, offered just last Friday to even accept his demands in regards to wages and the pension, which was really in good shape when he came in compared to the rest of the country. And he turned that down. And what he wants is for collective bargaining and recognition of unions, teachers' unions, and our union, to cease.
All right. Now, I want to get Chris Edwards in on this conversation.
Sure.
Chris, what is your response to what Gerald McEntee has just said?
I think the issue here is that, you know, the statistical studies show that overall state and local worker wages are reasonable overall. There is a long line of academic research that shows that unionization in either the public or private sector does boost wages by about 10 or 15%. But the big problem is the pension problem. And I do think collective bargaining and unions stand in the way of this giant pension problem, which runs $3 or $4 trillion dollars for state and local workers. You asked why it's such a big issue. It's because there's about 18 million state and local workers. Half of all state and local spending, over $1 trillion a year, is in the wages and benefits of government workers. So that's why it's important. But it's all...
All right, we've got to take just a short break. Gerald McEntee, can you hold on?
Sure, sure.
Okay, short break, and we'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org, by the David Geffen Foundation, supporting the vital role of quality journalism in this nation's civic life, and by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
The Life and Times of Wild Bill Donovan, the controversial founding father of American espionage. It's the tale of an heroic figure and his personal tragedies, a spy drama, and a story of political intrigue at the highest levels of government. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We are talking about what's happening out in Wisconsin to public sector unions, what may in fact be happening in other parts of the country as well. On the line with us, before we open the phones, Gerald McEntee. He's president of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I want to ask you one more question before we go to the phones, Mr. McEntee, and that is whether there have been negotiations with public sector workers over pension benefits, because that does seem to be a huge part of the problem.
Yes, there's negotiations over some of the pensions, but usually the pensions, Diane, are legislative business belonging to the House, the Senate, and whomever the employer is, the governor, for example. And it's important to note that in Wisconsin, the pension fund is nearly fully funded, and it's really not a problem that Scott Walker lets on that it is. Also, in pension systems, Public employees pay more than their fair share to the pension system. Part of the problem with pensions around the country is that employers, and whether that's New Jersey and this present governor who talks about pensions all the time, whether it's there or whether it's Texas or wherever, the employers over a period of time have not put in their fair share. Whenever they have, or seemingly whenever they have, a budgetary problem, they hold back their pension costs and use that money to take care of their budgetary problem. And as a result, we do find ourselves in a number of places with pensions that are out of sync. Out of sync meaning that the employers have not put in their fair share. Mm-hmm.
Gerald McEntee, he's president of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
All right, and now we'll open the phones first to Concord, New Hampshire. Good morning, Audi. You're on the air.
Good morning. Earlier, your speaker said that government employees are making 50% more than the private sector does, and have better benefits. And while that may be true of some government employees, I don't think it's fair to say that of school teachers. And my spouse is a veteran school teacher. She's been teaching inner city schools for the better part of 15 years, and she has a postgraduate education. And she's lucky if she can even get a job as a school teacher. But her salary hovers right around $30,000 a year. And every year, the length of the school year grows. So saying that they get paid over the summer is not really that fair anymore, because they're teaching all the way into June, and they're starting in August now. And when she started teaching right after college, that was not true. They're taking away more and more of their vacation days, and they're taking away benefits. She definitely doesn't get a 401k contribution. So I just don't see how it's fair to include teachers in that.
All right. Chris.
Yeah, I agree that the wages are not the big problem with state and local employees. It is pensions. And, I mean, your last guest, I didn't quite understand his data on Wisconsin. A recent study showed that Wisconsin's pension is underfunded or overpromised. It's about 32% of state GDP is the amount of underfunding or overpromising in Wisconsin benefits. That's a little above average. It's not the worst state. The worst states are Ohio, Illinois, New Jersey. But Wisconsin does have a substantial problem. I mean, my point here is that I think because of this problem, state managers need the maximum amount of flexibility to make adjustments. And again, states like Virginia are extremely well-run. Pew found that Virginia is one of the best-run states in the country. Fiscally, it has no collective bargaining for city, county, state workers at all. It has union peace. So I think that states should look at states as a model, like Virginia, North Carolina, that don't have unionization in the public sector.
Chris, pardon me, Ron Blackwell.
Yes, I think Chris and I have a number of different views on this empirically, both with Wisconsin and nationally. But I think we could agree that if you adjust for education and experience levels, public sector workers are not paid any more than private sector workers. And that includes, the way I look at it, compensation, pensions included. But also, Jerry McEntee didn't mention that, these are not exorbitantly paid people. Your guest, Audi, just mentioned what a teacher gets paid in Wisconsin. But, the typical pension for an AFSCME member after a lifetime of public service is about $19,000 a year. Now, that's not an exorbitant pension to expect to have to live on, having devoted your life to public service for a career. Now, it's the decrepit state of pensions in general in this country has left a lot of private sector people without even that. And there perhaps is some resentment of that. But I don't think it's too much to ask in the richest country in the history of the world that we'd be able to afford the people who teach our children, that they'll be able to retire on more than $20,000 a year.
Let's go to Sturgis, Michigan. Good morning, Irv.
Good morning. I would like to comment a little bit. public sector employees, I am strongly in support of their fight to retain their collective bargaining rights. And when they speak of perhaps them doing a little better than people in the private sector, it's only because over the last 30 years, working men and women in this country have been taking a terrible hit. For 38 years, I was in the private sector, in the automotive industry, a member of the UAW, and I was able to raise my family in a dignified manner. I think everyone in this country should be able to do that. You know, the people that have replaced me in the workplace at American Axle and Manufacturing in Three Rivers are the working poor now. They start at $10 an hour. Now, we need to protect collective bargaining in this country, and we need to start taxing the wealthy. They can afford it. They won't even feel it. This gentleman just talked about a $19,000 pension for teachers. Can you live on that? Very hard to.
Chris.
Well, I mean, we've seen what happens when unions demand too much in the private sector. Unions are going the way of the dinosaurs in the private sector in the United States because they make companies too uncompetitive. And so in the public sector, the problem is you have monopoly government services, you get monopoly unions on top of that, and these states are going to price themselves out, and the ultimate burden lands on taxpayers. Again, there's many states that do not have unions in the public sector, and they're very well run in general. So we don't need unions in the public sector.
Okay, let's look at this from the perspective of what Ben Mansky had to say, that what the governor did shortly after he came into office was to grant these huge tax breaks for corporations. Had he not done so, would this hammer have come down on public employees, Chris?
I mean, one of the great ironies here is that in the global economy we live in, corporate taxes, the federal corporate tax, the state corporate tax, land on workers. If Wisconsin increased taxes on their corporations would leave the state, there'd be less investment in Wisconsin, and ultimately workers in Wisconsin would have lower wages. Corporate taxes land on the productivity of industry. Lower productivity means lower wages in the global economy.
Here's an email from Scott and Gwen, who says, looks to me like the unions have already destroyed American manufacturing, put the U.S. auto industry on life support, sold out on the quality of public education, and driven the states to near bankruptcy. What do you think, Ron?
Even if it were true that unions operate the way Chris is suggesting they do, that they're double monopoly power, we simply don't have the power, especially in the private sector, to make U.S. business non-competitive. U.S. business is non-competitive because of many things, but it's not because of unions. The problem in the auto industry that was just discussed was not because of the UAW contract. The background here in the private sector is that real wages have not increased, and your caller from UAW mentioned this, in 35 years. Productivity has soared two-thirds higher than that. There's plenty of money out there, but it's not showing up in the pockets of working people. And they've put everybody in the family to work to try to sustain their living standards. They borrowed enormous amounts of money and against their house, which has now been destroyed. And now the resulting deficits of this crisis are being visited on those very people who were the victims of this crisis.
Let's go now to Indianapolis. Good morning, Tom.
Hi. Thank you. I just wanted to respond to some things that Governor Daniel said. Calling the government workers and elites of America is the most preposterous thing I've heard. I have two very close friends. Both teachers have been teaching over 20 years apiece, leaders in their departments, and they get more and more work every year from the top down, and have less time to do real teaching in their classes, and they feel totally under attack. And there's legislation in our state that is going after the teachers and the unions, and they've been down at the state house protesting. They're both Republicans, and they feel completely under attack after 20 years of service they're some of the best teachers in any schools, and they can't, and they're not appreciated. And then, at the same time, they're the Republican Congress in our state, both houses are controlled by the Republicans, are giving public monies from public education funds to private charter schools and taking more of the money out of the public school system.
Chris.
Well, you know, this is the reality in the private sector where I work is that you have to compete. You got to go in every day and work hard, and there's many other people who would want to take your job. In the public sector, it is an elite in that the extreme high job security, federal, state, local governments, and that is worth something. So we can talk about, I don't believe that teachers generally are overpaid, but they do have this extreme high job security that people in the private sector don't have. And as we've discussed, almost all full-time state local workers, there's about 18 million of them, they get defined benefit pension plans, a guaranteed pension. In the private sector, they don't have those anymore. I mean, you have 401k plans, and people contribute. In Wisconsin, government workers should at least contribute to their pension plans.
Here is an email from Colleen in Dallas, Texas. Please advise your listeners that all states do not have public employee unions. Chris has already said that. She says, I am a retired Texas public employee. I have had no increase in my retirement pension since 2001, but my health insurance premium has multiplied. My Medicare deduction has more than doubled. My Social Security has not increased enough to cover the Medicare deduction. Ron.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, Chris keeps saying it's a privilege to be in the public sector versus the private sector. But the point here is that we have had a 35-year decline of living standards in this country. And that includes both wages, job security, but also the security of retirement.
How much job security do teachers actually have?
I think there's more security because there's public laws in most states and at the federal level. You can't hire and fire people at will as you can in most private employers, but that's not necessarily a good thing.
Ron Blackwell, he's chief economist for the AFL-CIO, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Las Vegas, Nevada. Good morning, James.
Good morning. 5 U.S.C. 7101, Congress has already declared that the right of employees to organize, bargain collectively, and participate through labor organizations safeguards the public interest, contributes to the effective conduct of public business, and facilitates and encourages amicable settlements agreements. Point two, eliminated collective bargaining doesn't balance any budget. And the third point is the elimination of collective bargaining is essentially a permanent solution to what is a short-term problem. A short-term deficit problem can be fixed in the short term, but you don't need a long-term solution to fix it.
Chris.
I don't know what code section he was referring to there, but, you know, in the private sector, collective bargaining goes back to the 1935 Wagner Act, but public sector workers were not included in the collective bargaining law of 1935. As Governor Daniels pointed out, Franklin Delano Roosevelt did not believe in unions in the public sector, and the general understanding up until the 60s is that there should be no unions in the public sector because it gives a privileged position to insiders in the government.
How do you respond?
Well, I've already said that I believe it's a fundamental human right. Whether or not it's recognized in the law, whether or not Franklin Delano Roosevelt supported it in the 1930s, it was a victory of the civil rights movement, interestingly, and the labor movement in the 1960s. And it started in Wisconsin, which makes it so ironic. It's in Wisconsin that the challenge to the fundamental human rights of working people of Wisconsin is taking place there.
And we have an email from Barry in Wisconsin who says the unions were not the ones who gambled pension funds on Wall Street.
That's right.
Or gave tax breaks to the top 2% of corporations. Those who destroyed the economy have the wealth to fix it with increased taxes, but they frame the deficits as if spending is entirely to blame. Chris.
Well, if you look at total state local budgets, a decade ago, state and local governments spent about 14% of GDP. Today, they spend 15% of GDP, a little more, despite two recessions. I agree that state and local management has been often to blame with the pension funding problems. CalPERS in California, for example, has been very irresponsible in how they've managed pension funds. So it's not just the union's fault.
And Ron, last word.
Listen, there's three dimensions to this thing. One is the collective bargaining issue, and that's just money. We can solve that. We've already promised we would. The other is the fundamental challenge on the rights of workers to organize and bargain collectively. That's an existential fight, and it will go on a long time and be very bitter. And the third thing, which I think is most important here, is politics.
Ron Blackwell, chief economist for the AFL-CIO. Chris Edwards, director of tax policies for Cato Institute. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Diane.
Thank you, Diane.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales.